Hey, good morning, folks. This is Pastor Dave at Plainfield Bible, and I'm coming to you this morning from my office Wednesday morning. I don't know, about 11 something. We're getting close to lunchtime. But we are going to continue our study of Hebrews this morning in Hebrews chapter 9. Now, my original intent was to do Hebrews 9, 1 through 10 this week. Well, that's still my intent, but in preparing and studying, I figured that, boy, it's a little much for one recording. So what I'm going to do is divide this week's lesson into two recordings, and we will do verses 1 through 5 this morning. I will come back tomorrow morning and record verses 6 through 10 so we can get a picture of what our author is trying to tell us in chapter 9. Now, we have talked much about this great high priest, a better ministry, a new covenant for the Son, Christ, who's been identified many times through these first 8 chapters. And in chapter 9, our author suddenly jumps back into the Old Testament, and we find ourselves in the middle of the tabernacle. We talked about the earthly tabernacle versus the heavenly tabernacle in chapter 8. Well, we are certainly in the earthly tabernacle, and he's going to use this as a point of contrast. This will lead into the next couple chapters where he starts talking about sacrifices and Jesus' ultimate once-for-all sacrifice that provides salvation, where these old covenant sacrifices could not ever achieve that end. So let me read our text for this morning, chapter 9, verses 1 through 5. It says, "Now even the first covenant had regulations of divine worship and the earthly sanctuary. For there was a tabernacle prepared, the outer one, or the first one, in which were the lampstand and the table and the sacred bread. This is called the holy place. Behind the second veil there was a tabernacle which is called the Holy of Holies, having a golden altar of incense and the Ark of the Covenant covered on all sides with gold, in which was a golden jar holding the manna, and Aaron's rod which budded, and the tables of the covenant. And above it were the cherubim of glory, overshadowing the mercy seat. But of these things we cannot now speak in detail." So, we will try to speak in a little more detail than what our author is giving us today for the purpose of our study and our exegesis of the text. But quite clearly, where we find ourselves is back in the tabernacle. He is giving us the picture. And I would argue that we can take this same layout and take it to the temple. We could take it to Solomon's temple. We could take it to Zerubbabel's temple. We can even, for the most part, take it to Herod's temple, although there are some major differences there with the ark being absent. Okay, and Zerubbabel's temple as well, clearly. So, but we could move this forward at least into Solomon's temple in terms of the place where God accepts worship. Okay, that's the picture, the earthly place where God has given us rules for worship. And remember that this tabernacle is what set Israel apart. The temple will do the same. And the interesting thing about the tabernacle, the interesting thing later about the temple, that other nations would marvel at, is they have this place. Ultimately, it will be a beautiful temple that Solomon constructs, but they have this place where they worship their God, and there are no idols. No idols. A temple or a tabernacle without an idol. And their God is not regional. Their God doesn't live in the hills or the valleys. Their God is enthroned in the heavens. And probably the most stark contrast with the pagan nations is that Israel's God is one. So a temple or a tabernacle with no idols, an all-encompassing God who is one. And again, this is what sets Israel apart. Dr. Moeller says about the tabernacle, "The exacting detail of the commands given in Exodus 25 to 30 demonstrates that Israel was not to worship like the pagans. While their pagan neighbors devised new ways to portray whatever false deity they honored, Israel was not to speculate, innovate, or experiment with what kind of house or what kind of objects for worship God preferred. And illicit worship, we know, brought dire consequences. We don't have to go very far after this is all constructed to find an example of that. In Leviticus chapter 10, remember Nadab and Abihu, it says in verse 1, "Now Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took their respective fire pans And after putting fire in them, placed incense on it and offered strange fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. And fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. See, the Lord wasn't okay with new innovations, new practices, new inventions. He gave very strict, specific rules for how he was to be worshipped by his people. So that's interesting. Because what have we been talking about for the last chapter or so, and even before that, is the superiority of Jesus' ministry, the obsolescence of the old covenant, the superiority of the new covenant. So what in the world is our author doing hanging out in the tabernacle? I thought we've moved past this. Well, that's what we'll figure out in the course of the next 2 days. I'll try to explain to you why we need to take these five verses and lay out the architectural design of the tabernacle. Now, before we get to all that, I want to make you aware that there are textual variance issues in this section of Scripture. There are textual variants within Hebrews, and I'm not. This isn't going to be a text criticism message. We're not going to do that. But I will stop and touch on some of these issues as we go through, because to understand them completely and correctly, we have to deal with them. Okay. So the other part is the difference in Exodus of the account of the tabernacle in the Hebrew versus the Septuagint. Okay? There are differences in the Hebrew text and the Greek text of the Old Testament. And then the question of whether how much the author's dependence upon the Septuagint might explain the anomalies of the passage. Are the differences that we see here in Hebrews versus what we see in Exodus because our author is using the Greek translation of the Scriptures? Right? I think that's rather overblown when we really get down to it. And I'll leave that to more text critical kind of guys. That's not my wheelhouse. But I will try to go through and address some of those issues as we exegete the text. So let's get to verse 1. Now, even the first covenant had regulations of divine worship in the earthly sanctuary. So let's define some terms with this introductory statement. The first covenant. What's the first covenant? The first covenant is the Mosaic covenant. That's the first covenant that verse 1 is talking about. What does he mean by regulations of divine worship? Well, those are the rules governing or related to worship. It's the rules broken by Nadab and Abihu when they were consumed by the fire of the Lord. Okay, think of Leviticus, and think of even sections of Exodus and Numbers and Deuteronomy where it lays out regulations of how God is to be worshipped. That's what he's talking about. So the first covenant had rules on how you were to worship God. What's the sanctuary that he's talking about here? What you'll notice in this section is that sanctuary tends to have some broad meaning, and tabernacle tends to have some broad meaning. And so we need to make sure we understand. When he says sanctuary in verse 1, even the first covenant had regulations of divine worship and the earthly sanctuary. Well, based on what he's talked about earlier in chapter 8, the earthly sanctuary is the tabernacle. Why does he call it the earthly sanctuary? Because he wants to make sure that we know, as we read or listen to this, that we are not talking about the true tabernacle he referenced in chapter 8, but the earthly tabernacle constructed by men, under the old covenant, built by men, pitched by men, not the true tabernacle that was modeled after in heaven. Okay? So here's a cutaway picture of the tabernacle, and you can see there the layout of what we have. And we'll talk about all these things that are here. Maybe you can see my arrow on the screen. I don't know if you can, but we've got the lampstand over here. We've got the table with the showbread over here on the right. Then we have this smaller altar of incense here right in front of the curtain. Here is the curtain that divides the holy place right here from the Holy of Holies. And then back in the Holy of Holies, only one piece of furniture, which is the Ark of the Covenant. Okay, now, verse 2. For there was a tabernacle prepared, the outer one. Now, here's what you need to understand. This, when he says tabernacle here, a tabernacle in the Greek is skene, it's tent. It's most of the time translated as tabernacle. That's usually what it's referencing in the New Testament. But I'll give you an example. Later on in Hebrews chapter 11, 9, when it's talking about Abraham being an alien in the land, and then his heirs, Isaac and Jacob, it says that he was dwelling in tents. Same word. Okay, so it can just mean tent. So when it says here there was a tabernacle prepared, the outer one, we're talking about the outer tent, the outer section on this side of the outer section of the tent in the holy of in the holy place, apart from the Holy of Holies. All right, so we're talking now about the holy place. And in that outer one, in which were the lampstand, the table, and the sacred bread, this is called the holy place. All right, those three things are mentioned as being in the holy place. Prepared refers to the initial construction. There was a tabernacle prepared. Well, when was that? That was Exodus 25 through Exodus 27. Very specific instructions on how the tabernacle was supposed to be constructed and furnished. Again, the outer one is the holy place, and it's outer because this is the first room one would enter when they entered into the sanctuary before reaching the Holy of Holies. Now, you may have, if you do not have a NASB, if you have an ESV or you have a King James or a New King James in front of you, your translation may not say outer. I'm pretty sure all those translations say first, the first one. Okay, and you can see why the NASB translators went with outer, because they're trying to help you with the interpretation. But first is actually probably a more accurate translation, because the Greek word there is protos. Okay, it's first. It's where we get the word prototype. Okay, it's the first, the proto or the protos. So the first room, okay? Not the first tabernacle in a whole. Compared to the earthly tabernacle, that's later. This is the outer court. This is not the outer court, but the outer room of the temple proper, okay? Holy place, right? And what's in this holy place? Well, the lampstand. If you want to see where the lampstand was put, that's Exodus 25, 31 to 40. There's a table, Exodus 25, 23 to 29. And upon that table, we find the sacred bread. That's Exodus 25, 30. And this is called the holy place. So it's just a description. All we have here is, hey, you guys remember the tabernacle, the earthly sanctuary? Let me tell you about it. There was a holy place, and within this holy place, we saw a lampstand. We saw a table with sacred bread. Then we get to verse 3, and it says, behind the second veil, there was a tabernacle which is called the Holy of Holies. That's how we know that he's talking about two sections, not two separate tabernacles. Hey, behind the second veil, he's laying it out. You walk into the holy place, you see the lampstand, you see the table with the sacred bread. There's another veil in front of you, and on the back side of that veil, that's the Holy of Holies. He's contrasting the Holy of Holies with the holy place. There is a division. That will become important in verses 6 through 10 and beyond. So the second veil, why does he call it the second veil? It's the veil that separated the holy place from the Holy of Holies. Holy of Holies is Hagia Hagion, the Holy of Holies. Your translation may say the most holy place. Okay, that's a perfectly legitimate translation. And if you want to learn about when that was constructed, this veil, that's Exodus 26, 31 to 33. Second veil distinguishes this curtain from the one that hung at the entrance to the outer court. If you read Exodus 26, 36, and 37, you'll see that there was a curtain that hung on the initial entrance into the holy place, and then there is a second curtain that hangs in front of the Holy of Holies. So he calls it the second veil because he wants to differentiate. When the one that separates the holy place from the Holy of Holies. Again, that becomes important in his argument later on. Verse 4. Having a golden altar of incense and the Ark of the Covenant covered on all sides with gold, in which was a golden jar holding the manna and Aaron's rod which budded, and the tables of the covenant. So again, let's go back to verse 3 and read 3 and 4 together, and maybe you're running ahead of me, but you'll see one of the issues that we need to address here. Behind the second veil, there was a tabernacle which is called the Holy of Holies, having a golden altar of incense and the Ark of the Covenant covered on all sides with gold, in which was a golden jar holding the manna and Aaron's rod which budded and the tables of the covenant. Now, what does it sound like? Well, it sounds like verse 3 transitioned from the holy place to the Holy of Holies, which it does. And then it seems like in verse 4 that it's telling us that both the altar of incense and the Ark of the Covenant are behind the Holy of Holies. What's the problem with that? Well, because we saw in the layout, okay, let me go back a few slides so you can see. We saw in the layout that table of incense, that altar of incense, is on this side of the Holy of Holies. It's in the holy place, not in the Holy of Holies. And so, what's the we have a problem here. We have an issue that we need to address, and we need to address well. Okay, so let's see what we can do. Let's go in order. Number one, what is the golden altar of incense? And number two, where is the golden altar of incense? I guess we could answer why the golden altar of incense too, but we won't do that today. Okay, what is it and where is it? Well, here's where some of the issue comes in. The Greek word is thumiaterion. Okay? It occurs twice in the Septuagint. 2 Chronicles 26:19 and Ezekiel 8:11. In both those places in the Septuagint, when thumaterion is used, it means a censer. It's the stick, the holder, the tongs kind of thing that you would use to pick up the coal from the altar of incense. So it means censer when it's used. But here, it's translated altar of incense. Do we just have a wrong translation? Should this be translated censer? Well, some would say that. But when we look at some contemporaries, Philo and Josephus, what do Philo and Josephus have in common? Well, they're both Greek-speaking Jews. Philo, early 1st century, Josephus, later 1st century. Both very important to our understanding of Judaism, of Jewish life, of traditions, of customs, of history. These guys are probably one and two on who we go to in terms of Jewish sources in the first century. Well, both Philo and Josephus use thumaterion to mean incense altar. What? Well, now we see how complicated this is. Okay? Our author uses thumaterion, and it's always translated incense altar. When we look back in the Septuagint, which is a few hundred years old, at least 200, 250, 300, somewhere in there, we find it being used to mean censer. But more contemporary sources that wrote at the same time as our author, they used it to mean incense altar. So which is it? Is this thumaterion, is it a censer? Is that all it is? Or is it the altar of incense? Okay. Well, I think we can figure this out. In all of Exodus 25 through 40 that deals with the tabernacle, there's a censer is never mentioned. A censer is never mentioned. Now, but the altar of incense is constructed in Exodus 30. The altar of incense fits much better with the narrative description that we have. Now, clearly we understand that censers were used in various ceremonies. But there was never a special censer. You know, there was never the censer set apart. So to use that as a piece of important furniture in his illustration doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. Even if it's the one that Aaron used during the Day of Atonement, that doesn't solve our problem, because it would be silly for Aaron to leave his censer, even if it was this special censer used only for the Day of Atonement, to be kept in the Holy of Holies. Why? Because he couldn't get to it. He's only allowed to enter into that place to offer sacrifice once a year. So, but he needs that his censer to get the tongs, to get the coals of incense off the altar, which is outside the Holy of Holies. So I don't think it makes much sense to say that it's a censer, because it doesn't solve the problem, and it may even cause some more problems. So I think thumaterion here is best translated altar of incense. Now, that brings us to our other question. Where is it? Because if our author is telling us that the altar of incense is inside the Holy of Holies, well, that contradicts Scripture. Let me show you. Upon first reading, it appears our author locates the altar of incense inside the Holy of Holies. Right? I mean, it's he starts in verse 3 about behind the second veil, calls it the Holy of Holies. Verse 4, he starts talking about this altar of incense. But we read in Exodus 30, verse 6, "You shall put this altar in front of the veil that is near the Ark of the Testimony, in front of the mercy seat that is over the Ark of the Testimony, where I will meet you." So it's supposed to be in front of it, not behind it. Okay? So what's the problem? It's this in other places as well. Is our author confused? Does our author not really know where this is? And here's a picture. That's the layout that we see in Exodus. So is our author just mistaken? Could he make a mistake in something like this? Well, here's why I think that's extremely unlikely. He is the authority on Hebrew things. How many times has he quoted the Old Testament so far in this letter? How many more times will he? When we get to chapter 11, he's going to give us an overarching history lesson of the Jewish people and the faith that they had in their God. So to say, well, he's just confused about the layout of the temple. No, these were religious. Religious Jews understood the layout of the temple. Of course they knew this. So that can't be it. So how do I explain this? Well, here's, I think, is my best attempt. The participle at the beginning of verse 4, where it says having. The Greek there is akousa. It doesn't refer to location, but refers to use. And it can be translated associated with. Okay, so he's not saying the altar of incense is behind in within the Holy of Holies. He's saying the altar of incense is associated with the Holy of Holies. And it was. It's immediately in front of the veil. It's the closest thing to the Holy of Holies. It's the closest thing to the Ark of the Covenant and the mercy seat. And on the Day of Atonement, the high priest brought incense from that altar into the Holy of Holies. That's in Leviticus chapter 16, verses 12 and 13. So I think a better reading, okay, is not having it behind there, but associated with it, right? It's near the whole. So the Holy of Holies is much more closely associated with the altar of incense than it is with the lampstand and the table and the showbread, because none of those things actually enter, have anything to do with the Holy of Holies in terms of practical use. But the incense that burned on the altar of incense was brought into the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement. So I think it's a participle of use, not a participle of location. Okay, hopefully that makes sense. So we move from the altar of incense to the Ark of the Covenant. And there's a picture of the Ark covered in gold with the sticks, the wood on the bottom for handles to carry. And then the cherubim on top. Okay? And our description is it's covered on all sides with gold. There's some grammatical stuff there. It doesn't just mean gold covered. It means the way it's laid out is this total encompassing part of gold all over this ark. And it's the only furniture within the Holy of Holies. And then inside that ark, we don't have any problem with the ark being in there. That's where it's supposed to be. That's the presence of God. That's the mercy seat. But it says inside the ark are said to be three items: a golden jar holding the manna, Aaron's rod which budded, and the tables of the covenant. Well, now here is our next issue with the text. The location of the jar of the manna and the staff in the ark is problematic. Why? Why is that problematic? Well, in Exodus 16:33, it reads, Moses said to Aaron, take a jar and put an omer full of manna in it and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. So it doesn't say anything about the manna going into the ark. It says to place it before him, in front of him. Numbers 17:10 says, but the Lord said to Moses, put back the rod of Aaron before the testimony to be kept as a sign against the rebels, that you may put an end to their grumblings against me so that they will not die. So both the manna and Aaron's rod that budded, which signified him to be the chosen high priest, they were laid before the ark, before the Lord, not in the ark. Okay? Now, there are some attempts by some commentators and stuff to say, to make that work, but from everything that I've read, and again, I'm no language expert, I know just enough to be dangerous, but most of the guys that I look at are saying you can't really make that assumption. You can't turn in front of and before to into. It's a little too big of a linguistic jump. Okay? What else makes this problematic? Well, we see in 1 Kings 8, verse 9, when Solomon dedicates the temple, it says, there was nothing in the ark except the two tablets of stone which Moses put there at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the sons of Israel when they came out of the land of Egypt. All right, so do you see our issue here? In verse 4, we have an ark with the tablets, the manna, and Aaron's rod that budded inside the ark. But in Exodus 16, the manna is put before the ark. And in Numbers 17, the rod is put before the ark. And in 1 Kings 8, when Solomon builds his temple and puts the ark there, it says quite explicitly, there's no manna there. There's no rod that budded there. There's just the two tablets. All right, what do we do with this? Are the manna and Aaron's rod inside the ark, or are they in front of the ark? Well, not to be too facetious here, but I'll let Tevye tell you here. I don't know. I don't know. And the problem is, everything we would do to try to figure out what's here is speculation. Now, we could speculate, and I'll give you some answers here. We don't hear about the jar of manna after Exodus 16:33. Aaron's staff isn't mentioned after it was used to strike the rock at Kadesh in Numbers chapter 20. So maybe originally they weren't in the ark, but maybe later they were put there for safekeeping. And then sometime in between, maybe when the Philistines captured the ark in 1 Samuel 4 through 6, maybe they took them out. But it would be nothing more than speculation. I think what we can say is that sometime between Numbers 20 and 1 Kings 8, the ark must have contained these items at some point, and the items then were removed. But we have no basis for that. There's no text about that. It's all speculation. All right. But because of our view of Scripture, because of our understanding of inspiration, we know he's not wrong. So there must be an explanation, but it's not essential for us. I mean, think about it. In verse 5, when we get there, he said, we don't have time to get into all this. This will be a question you can ask when you get to the kingdom. You know, so what was up with that? Were they actually in the ark? And he'll probably go, that's what you're worried about? But that's all we can do right here is speculate. All right. Now, let's get back to what we know. Verse 5. And above it were the cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat. But of these things, we cannot now speak in detail. All right, what are we talking about with the cherubim? Those are your angels that sit on top of the ark, and they overshadow the mercy seat. That flat piece in between the cherubim is the mercy seat. But what's up with the cherubim? Why do we have them on the ark? Well, the cherubim of glory. Cherubim represent God's presence and the manifestation of his glory. The angels are always there in the midst of his glory. Now, there are seraphim in Isaiah chapter 6, but it's reminiscent of that. The overshadowing, you can see those wings are over the mercy seat. That's what it means. And that overshadowing is in the present tense, which is interesting. So it indicates a continuing state. The cherubim still surround the throne of God. In heaven today, the angels still do that same thing. The cherubim continue in that task, and they will always continue in that task. I'll show you that in a second. In Genesis 3:24, it's the cherubim that guard the entrance to the Garden of Eden after Adam and Eve are ejected from the garden. In Ezekiel 10 and 11, cherubim escort the presence of God out of the temple when he departs in 592. If you read that section of Scripture, it talks of all the blasphemy and the heretical stuff that has been going on, and God's presence actually leaves that temple, and ultimately in 586 it will be destroyed by the Babylonians. And here's what I meant when I said, not only does it continue to go on, it will always continue to go on. Revelation 5. Now, it doesn't say cherubim specifically here, but based on what we know of them, I think these angels are that very much that. It says, then I looked, and I heard the voice of many angels around the throne, and the living creatures and the elders, and the number of them was myriads of myriads and thousands of thousands, saying with a loud voice, worthy is the Lamb that was slain to receive power and riches and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing. And every created thing which is in heaven and on the earth and under the earth and of the sea and all things in them I heard saying, to him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be blessing and honor and glory and dominion forever and ever. That is our Christ. That is the risen Lamb on the throne. And not only do what we know of his people, all of the earth praises him, but what's the first thing that we see? Many angels around the throne. The angels confirm the glory of God. Those are cherubim. That's exactly what is portrayed on top of the Ark of the Covenant. And finally, we talk about the mercy seat, the hilasterion in Greek. Two golden images of cherubim, one on each side, overshadow the mercy seat in the middle. Why do they call it the mercy seat? Because that's where the high priest would sprinkle blood. When he came in for the atoning sacrifice each year, he would sprinkle blood on that mercy seat below the cherubim, overshadowed by the glory of God, and that's where the blood was sprinkled. It was the place where sins were forgiven by God because of the atoning blood that was sprinkled upon it. Of course, we understand from earlier that was done on an annual basis. The priest had to come in every year to do that. Okay, so what have we gotten here? But basically a walking tour through the tabernacle. He took us into the holy place. He said, remember the earthly sanctuary. It's built here. It had rules for worship. You entered the holy place. You saw the lampstand. You saw the table. You saw the showbread. As you approached the Holy of Holies, you saw that curtain. You saw the altar of incense that was used in association with the ark. If you went into the Holy of Holies, you would have seen, although you wouldn't have been able to under the Old Covenant, more on that tomorrow, you would have seen the Ark of the Covenant covered in gold, cherubim overshadowing the mercy seat, and the glory of God would have been there. Okay? That's verses 1 through 5. And I just wanted to make sure we understood. I wanted to go over those textual issues with you. But you can see why we didn't keep going, because this would have been an hour plus message. I want to come back tomorrow and dig into verses 6 through 10 to show us why our author chose to take us on this tour. And the concluding observation he gives is, but of these things we cannot now speak in detail. I think more specifically, he's basically saying this is not the time to go into detail about this. Okay? He's using this as a springboard. Verse 6 is going to transition us into a new paragraph and explain why we need to understand what went on at the tabernacle. You and again, he's talking to Hebrew readers, Hebrew listeners. They know exactly what he's talking about. They know exactly the layout of the tabernacle. They know what it looks like. They know the details. They know how one was supposed to worship in those days. And so he takes them back there. And after saying the old covenant is obsolete, the new covenant is superior, Jesus is our great high priest. But let me tell you, even the first tabernacle had rules of worship. And he walks us through this tour. And in verse 6, he's going to transition into everything else. He's going to say in verse 6, now when these things have been so prepared, the priests are continually entering the outer tabernacle performing. He's going to start laying in. Think of how specific. Think of how intricate. Think of how beautiful that tabernacle was. And that's going to push us into a new covenant, a new way of worship, okay? A new manner of high priest, a new manner of covenant. That's what we'll talk about tomorrow. I hope this was interesting. I hope it helps set the table a little bit. I hope it gives you a better understanding of what the tabernacle was all about. And hopefully we address some issues. Okay? And again, those aren't things I can be overly dogmatic about. Some of that stuff we just have to say, well, I'm not quite sure, but I know this is the Word of God. Okay? And it's not something that impacts salvation. We're not talking about a deep doctrinal issue here. We're talking about what a participle means in terms of location or use. Do you understand that? So I hope that's not too in the weeds. I hope that helps set the table for where we're going to go tomorrow. So I hope you'll listen to that as well. Hope you guys are doing well. I'm praying for you. And for my PBC family, again, I can't wait to see you again. But hopefully we can at least stay connected here and bond over the truth of the Word of God. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.